We spend more than one-third of our lives sleeping, but despite a lot of scientific inquiry, we still don't understand exactly what happens to us when we sleep. On today's edition of Please Explain, we're looking into why we sleep, why we sometimes can't sleep, and the consequences of not sleeping enough. Joining us are Dr. Alan Pack, Chief of the Division of Sleep Medicine and Professor of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Michelle Kramer-Borneman, co-director of the Minnesota Regional Sleep Disorder Center at Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Alan, why do certain aspects of sleep remain a mystery?
Well, I think up until recently, we really haven't had the tools to go after that question at a very fundamental level. Now we can look at molecular biology, and we can look at changes in gene expression that take place during sleep and wake and with sleep deprivation. And I think they are beginning to elucidate some of the likely functions of sleep, at least in the brain. And there's not as many studies in the periphery, you know, in heart and lung and so on. But I think the studies that have been done looking at changes in gene expression in the brain are really beginning to give clues as to why we sleep.
It's after the development of polysomnography?
No, well, polysomnography certainly is a tool that allows us to describe the EEG changes during sleep, and we certainly know a lot about the nature of sleep in terms of, you know, what happens across the night in terms of electrical activity. And that has provided some clues about the different stages of sleep, has led to some hypotheses about what different stages of sleep, you know, non-rapid eye movement and rapid eye movement being dream sleep. And then more recently, the use of molecular biology and gene expression studies in animals has elucidated some of the very fundamental changes that are taking place in the cells in the brain when you sleep and when you're awake.
So we can learn about human sleep by looking at what happens when animals sleep?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, certainly there's the things we can do in humans. The things we can do in humans to elucidate some of the functions of sleep and what changes in the brain with sleep are, as we've talked about, polysomnography, which involves the EEG measures and so on. And then the other thing that we can do in humans, and there's more and more techniques now available to do that, is neuroimaging. You know, seeing what happens in the brain metabolically during sleep, which areas in the brain shut down during sleep and so on. And there is development now of tools to begin to think about what changes might take place in molecular mechanisms. But studying molecular mechanisms is much easier in animals.
Michelle, a recent survey by the National Sleep Foundation shows that one-third of Americans are losing sleep due to worrying about the economy and personal finances. Is stress a leading cause of people not being able to sleep enough?
Well, you know, honestly, I think culturally there's always been a strong bent to disrespect sleep. If you look, centuries ago, even Benjamin Franklin was quoted of saying, "Plow deep while sluggards sleep." So, in many ways, this country has always had a strong tendency for an individual work ethic that has completely disregarded the importance of sleep. And it's only been within, say, the recent decades where we've appreciated the importance of sleep in many ways, because we've had the tools to scientifically and clinically evaluate the importance of this, in part because we now understand clinical disorders that are associated with clinical entities such as obstructive sleep apnea, as well as the consequences of sleep deprivation.
Now, I remember reading when I was a kid that Thomas Alva Edison only got 4 hours of sleep a day, and that allowed him to do all the brilliant things he did. And now, with what I know about sleep and how much sleep we supposedly need, I worry for Edison. Now, the Japanese film director Akira Kurosawa made a film called The Bad Sleep Well. Do you think that people who are worrying about things and worrying about their personal problems are less likely to sleep well? And do they sleep better when things are going well?
Well, I think what this tells us is that we already have a culture based upon the foundation of sleep deprivation, where we're inundated with influences that further erode this, whether it's the marketing influences on teenagers with hypercaffeinated products, electronic devices that are brought into the bedroom, and now we have an economy in further recession with anxiety. I mean, where does the cycle end? So clearly, we have an erosion with this anxiety, stress, economics. These all further to compound the problem for which we've already been built upon this. So clearly, there's an issue here, but this is only the tip of the iceberg.
Alan, we've heard that 8 hours of sleep is what we should be getting. Is that true for everyone?
No, I think there's a variation. I mean, clearly, if you look at the average amount of sleep that the population would need, it would be related to about 8.1 hours of sleep would get you to maximal alertness. So that's an average number. But clearly, there's variation around that average number. And the individual need for sleep varies between individuals. It's very difficult to know if an individual reports sleeping less than 6 hours a night, whether they're just undersleeping, as we talked about, and are sleep-deprived and impaired, or are there individuals who sleep less than 6 hours a night who can function perfectly well because that it meets the need for whatever the functions of sleep are.
Well, can we accurately determine just how much sleep we need by sleeping for a while without an alarm clock? Because some of us just wake up at the same time every day before the alarm will even go off.
Yeah, I mean, the timing of going to sleep and waking up is really set by your biological clock, and that varies between individuals. Some people, you know, can't sleep till late. Other people sleep early. So that's another individual difference. And certainly, if you're on vacation or something and there's no pressures to go to early meetings or anything like that, and you can see your normal sleep pattern emerging, I think that's really helpful. And clearly, the answer, when people ask you how much sleep do you need, the answer to that is that amount of sleep that keeps you alert and not falling asleep inappropriately during the day. And there are individual differences, we believe, in the amount of sleep that people need.
Well, Michelle, what about naps? Are they good if we're not getting enough sleep at night?
Well, absolutely. Strategically placed naps can minimize the accumulation of sleep debt that we experience as the week goes on. However, I would venture to warn individuals that napping for too long of a duration could contribute to potential sleep initiation and insomnia at night. Also, napping that we understand clinically is if we take too long of a nap could progress to the point that an individual might experience slow wave sleep. And if a nap progresses into slow wave sleep, you could wake up with sleep inertia and actually feeling groggy, some degree of cognitive impairment, and feeling quite a bit dulled if you wake up with that type of experience. So we recommend a strategically placed nap in an appropriate time of day is helpful to minimize the accumulation of sleep debt, but perhaps a nap no more than, say, 15 minutes would be helpful.
I remember even in high school, and that was a long time ago for me, being told that you can't catch up on lost sleep, that if you sleep 4 hours one night and then sleep 12 hours the next, it really doesn't correct the loss of the first night's sleep. Is that true?
Well, no, that's not true. It's clear that you can't store sleep, but you can certainly catch up on sleep. And I think naps go a long way with catching up on sleep and helping to minimize, if not eradicate, the accumulated sleep debt.
Alan, shouldn't kids, especially teenagers, be getting more than 8 hours?
Yeah, well, I mean, there is some data to suggest that the need for sleep, you know, or the amount of sleep people need varies across the lifespan, and it does seem that teenagers, as a group, look like they need more sleep, yeah.
Is that because our circadian clocks change over time?
Well, I think there's two features to the control of sleep. One is the clock itself, which sets the timing for sleep and also gives an arousal signal out during the day. And that clearly changes across the lifespan. I mean, teenagers tend to be more delayed, and then as you age, the time you go to sleep tends to advance, and you sleep at an earlier time. And so that's one component of the regulation of sleep is the clock. The other component is a drive mechanism to sleep. The longer you're awake, the bigger the drive to sleep is. And as we talked about, if you miss sleep, then the next night when you go to sleep, you're going to have deeper sleep and you're going to sleep longer because the drive is higher. And it does look like that drive for sleep also varies across the lifespan. So I think it's both the clock changing across the lifespan and the drive mechanism for sleep changing across the lifespan as well.
Some people suggest that schools, especially high schools, should start later in the morning than they currently do.
Yeah, I think there's good data to support that when if people go to school very early, you know, they're still very sleepy, they haven't met the sleep need, because if they're more delayed and they need longer sleep, then if they have to get up at 6:30 or something in the morning to catch the school bus at 7 or whatever it is, then by the time they get to sleep, they really haven't met their whole sleep need. And so for the first couple of periods when they're at school, they may be napping inappropriately during the class. And so it doesn't make a lot of sense to a very early school start times, particularly when you add in the travel time, because then people basically are not getting the sleep they need and they're not allowed to sleep the way the clock is telling them to.
My guests are Dr. Alan Pack, Chief of the Division of Sleep Medicine and Professor of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Michelle Kramer-Borneman, Co-Director of the Minnesota Regional Sleep Disorder Center at Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis. It's Please Explain, and in a little while we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Michelle, what are the effects of not getting enough sleep on your health? There was an article in the New York Times health section recently that said getting enough sleep is important to support the immune system.
Well, you know, clearly there's the acute impact of sleep deprivation, which I think we first need to emphasize and not overlook, because that's often glossed over, is that the acute impact of sleep deprivation is the most urgent issue here, and that's the impact of falling asleep during the daytime, which clearly has safety implications for the individual, if not public impact. Also, we have to think about, you know, and people think about, you know, falling asleep and then that there could be some premonition that might happen, but we have to look at that there could be cognitive impairment with that, and we talk about errors of omission and commission. So that could be significant importance, particularly of individuals that work in public sectors. You know, the Exxon Valdez is an example of errors of omission and commission. So it's not necessarily somebody just flat out falling asleep on the job. We're talking about individuals that have to respond appropriately in significant sectors of our community. So we have to look about the acute impact. Just yesterday, from a flight from San Diego to Minneapolis, we have a Northwest Airlines that overshot the flight into Minneapolis by 150 miles. Now, we're trying to determine why did those pilots, two pilots overshoot Minneapolis by 150 miles. We're trying to determine, the NTSB is trying to determine what the cause of that is. But one of the factors that has been raised is this pilot safety, you know, pilot fatigue. Just last year, we had a flight from Honolulu to Hilo, where two pilots clearly admitted that they both fell asleep. I mean, so we have to look at the acute impact of fatigue and sleepiness.
Right. Now, but I'm even thinking along other terms. Depressed people tend to sleep longer. Is there some kind of link between the two?
Well, I think we have to be clear that depressed individuals have the subjective experience of sleepiness, but when you actually objectively evaluate them, they actually don't sleep as long as they subjectively relay to a physician. So they may experience fatigue, but that's clearly different than objective measured sleepiness, and we can't confuse the two. So that's a whole different, you know, ball of wax here. But again, you know, we have to look at the acute impact of sleep deprivation. Now, when we look at longitudinal, clearly there's a lot of research in this regard, and I'm sure Dr. Pack can speak to this much better than I can. We're starting to see compromises in the immune system in this regard, and this can be measured on several accounts with compromises. For example, there's been some studies looking at when you vaccinate individuals in a research project, what do you see with vaccination titers, antibody titers after vaccination? And you can see that the antibody titers are less in sleep-deprived individuals compared to individuals who aren't sleep-deprived. Well, what is the clinical significance of that? We're not sure, but it's clear that the effects of sleep deprivation, however you cut it, is not good. There are other aspects when you look at different components of the immune system and its effect with sleep deprivation that there are significant compromises. What is the true clinical impact of that has yet to be determined, but it's clear that all of these compromises or fluctuations are not in a positive direction.
Now, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll find out what we do know about what happens during sleep, what happens to our nervous system, what dreams may or may not signify, and if we'll get to whatever else we can get to. We'll also be taking a lot of calls from our listeners. Our number here is 212-433-9692. And my guests are Dr. Michelle Kramer-Borneman, co-director of the Minnesota Regional Sleep Disorder Center at Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis, which was just recently overshot by two pilots by 150 miles. Well, maybe they want to go to someplace else in Minnesota. Dr. Alan Pack, Chief of the Division of Sleep Medicine and Professor of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. It's Please Explain. We are inviting your calls, 212-433-9692. We're back with Please Explain, talking about sleep with Drs. Alan Pack, Chief of the Division of Sleep Medicine and Professor of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Michelle Kramer-Borneman, co-director of the Minnesota Regional Sleep Disorder Center at Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis. Before we get to the calls, I just want to ask you the basic question, and I throw this out to both of you. What's happening when I'm lying in bed, dead tired, yet I can't seem to cross that line into falling into sleep? I take a peek at the clock, and I realize I've been lying there for over an hour, and I try to will myself to sleep. If sleep doesn't come because we're tired, what actually brings it on? Michelle?
Sorry.
Well, I'll defer that to Dr. Pack. That's an age-old question. It's still very difficult to answer.
We don't know, Dr. Pack.
No, I think we do know that there's a drive mechanism for sleep, as we talked about, which is coupled to how long you've been awake, and that is the drive to get you to sleep. But clearly that drive to sleep can be counteracted by a number of other processes. So if your brain is racing, you're really engaged in a lot of thoughts, you're anxious and so on, that can overcome the drive for sleep. So there's other processes in the brain that can overcome that. And that's one of the reasons, you know, there's a technique for people who have insomnia called cognitive behavioral therapy, where what you're trying to do is get rid of these other influences and allow the drive system to dominate and get you to sleep. So there is a drive system. It just can be overcome by other influences.
Isn't there something that's been called a sleep switch in the hypothalamus?
There are cells in the ventrolateral preoptic area of the hypothalamus that are sleep-active cells. So basically what you find when you're awake is many of your neurons are firing, as you can imagine, because you're processing a lot of information. And then when you go to sleep, what happens is there's not a ton of these cells, but there's a number of cells you've indicated in a particular area of the hypothalamus that become active. And these are sleep cells. These are cells that actually inhibit the wake system, and they shut off all the wake active systems. And so there is, in that sense, a sleep switch. There are cells that become active in the brain in the hypothalamus during sleep, and they act to inhibit and to turn off the systems that are active during wakefulness.
So the problem, though, is we can try to understand this from a scientific perspective, the switch from a neurochemical perspective. But when we take it from a patient's perspective, what we have is this, is that The difficulty with initiating sleep is we have objective information which doesn't necessarily match the subjective patient experience. And so patients will often report much more problems than what we commonly see from an objective perspective. And we see this over and over again, whether it's monitored longitudinally or in a sleep lab. So, for example, we may objectively see that an individual who has sleep initiation insomnia may report from a lab perspective, whether it's your actigraphy, one diagnostic measure from a sleep lab, difficulty in initiating sleep from, say, anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes, but the patient's actually reporting 2 hours of difficulty initiating sleep. So we can actually monitor and explain things from a perspective from science, but the patient is reporting something completely different. What they actually are reporting, something that is a hyperactivated state. And what can we do to account for that perspective, and that is something that we can't quite fully account for at this particular point.
Despite all the research. Let's go to our first caller, Chuck from Rockland County. Hi, you're on the air.
Chuck? Hi, how are you?
Go ahead.
I have a question about exercise and sleep, how it affects sleep. I'm 61. I exercise a lot, and I sleep wonderfully, but if I don't get more than 8.5 hours of sleep, after that kind of exercise, I'm exhausted.
So the question again is the exercise.
How does exercise impact your sleep?
In general, there's always been this idea that the exercise would negatively impact sleep, you know, prior to the sleep period, and what we find is that's not necessarily the case. What appears to be the situation is that rituals are very important to maintain boundaries and appropriate programming for sleep. So rituals for sleep are very important, and if an exercise ritual is part of that, that seems to be a positive influence.
What is there something physiological that's happening during sleep helps you in terms of exercise and the damage, I guess, that you're doing to your body when you're exercising?
And let me add to that. Do athletes need more sleep? Michelle?
I'm not well-versed in that particular area. I know that there are individuals that are doing quite a bit of research in that realm, but I personally am not well-versed in that area.
He talked about exercise before sleep. Some people will have a glass of wine or something like that to calm themselves before sleep. Is that a good idea, or is it better to drink warm milk like my mother used to suggest?
Well, I think clearly wine would not be recommended. We know that alcohol has been known to help initiate sleep, but there are more negative repercussions to alcohol than there are positives. Alcohol is known to deteriorate slow-wave sleep and also help to cause fragmentation in sleep, so it actually has more negative ramifications than it does positive, and clearly a nightcap before sleep is not recommended. However, though I'm not a strong proponent of this, there are those that do see some positive influences with warm milk and other food additives, because they talk about, you know, tryptophan effect with sleep. I can certainly understand some of the positives with that, but I tend to feel that those are such minor influences that I think that there are other stronger influences with the maintenance of sleep than actually doing that. I think what's more important is that all of us have certain rituals with sleep that are important to help to maintain the consolidation and sleep pattern, which is probably more important in those situations.
Alan, how do sleeping pills work? Are they, because I know there were some negative side effects of some sleeping pills.
Well, I mean, sleeping pills basically act to activate, you know, these cells that we talked about that really promote sleep. I mean, they act specifically on certain benzodiazepine receptors. You know, Valium-like drugs act on benzodiazepine receptors, and these drugs are quite specific for a particular subclass of these receptors, and therefore they shift the balance so that the sleep-promoting system
is got a higher drive, if you like, than the wake-promoting system, and therefore you get to sleep. The newer drugs clearly are much more specific than the drugs we had in the past. The issues with them are, you know, maybe you get long-term effects, and when you wake up, you still have this excessive sleep-promoting, and so you're not totally alert and so on. So these are some of the side effects. And what we tend to do in sleep medicine, if we have people who have insomnia, is we tend to not go down the pharmacological route, but try to use cognitive behavioral therapy, which is something that clinical psychologists do. And there's fairly good randomized trial data using cognitive behavioral therapy showing that the effects of that are just as powerful as these sleeping aids, and they have long-lasting effects as well. So there's really good data to support that strategy.
We talked about earlier about kids needing more sleep, and a caller says his children have to be at school at 6:30 and wants to know if there's a good book regarding sleep deprivation so that he can bring it to the school principals and say, "You're harming my kids."
Yeah, there are some books out there for the lay public, and then there's some articles you could find in PubMed, which are, you know, good review articles on sleep deprivation. And you know, the way that we talked before about the consequences in terms of behavior, you know, falling asleep and so on, and we talked about the immune consequences. The other aspect of chronic sleep deprivation, and my colleague here differentiated acute deprivation from chronic, people not sleeping enough night after night. What we know with that is if you do that in a laboratory setting in normal humans, you change the way they handle glucose and insulin, and you're sort of like pre-diabetic. And then the other thing we know is it changes the hormone levels that are related to appetite control. And so we believe that not only are there behavioral consequences of not enough sleep, and as we talked about earlier, immune consequences, but there's also consequences on our metabolism. And we believe that chronic partial sleep loss is a risk factor for subsequent obesity, and there's data to support that.
Wow.
One excellent resource, I think, my colleague Dr. Howald and colleague in the field, Dr. Mary Karskaden, have been instrumental with working with school start times and actually lobbied in support of this on Washington, D.C. on the Hill. But an excellent resource in support of this, aside from books, would be the website of the National Sleep Foundation. And what you'll find on the website is actually a tab on information on school start times and children. And I think that might be a decent place to start to get information in that regard to help you with your search in that manner.
Our next caller is Mark from Jackson Heights, Queens. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Briefly, I work at Good Morning America on ABC, and our call time is 3 a.m. so that we can get the show on at 7. And my life by necessity involves sleeping a split shift, sleeping a few hours in the evening before getting up to go to work, sleeping a couple hours after work, so that there's time in between to actually get to spend time with my wife, whose work schedule doesn't allow her to, let's say, spend a few hours with me right after work or, you know, get up early with me. So I'm wondering about anything the guys have to say about the ramifications of breaking sleep up into, like, 4 and 3 or 4 and 2, as I often have to do.
Which one of you wants to take that?
Well, I mean, I could say a little about it. I mean, clearly, the lifestyle that you've got, I mean, our biological clock wasn't built for that lifestyle. I mean, just to say that right up front, because, you know, we have this exquisite system that really is controlling the timing of sleep, and you're sort of overriding it by the you know, what you need to do for your work. And so everything is going to be a compromise based on the fact that you're not able to do what your biology really is programmed to do. In terms of 4 and 2 or whatever that is, I don't know good data to support whatever that different strategies might be. I think in the situation you're in, clearly getting the total amount of sleep that you need across the day is really an important thing to maintain alertness and understanding your own clock, because one of the things that people don't appreciate is that you cannot just fall asleep at will. The clock is really setting the window in which you can sleep.
And there's two windows at which you can sleep pretty well. One is the siesta time right after lunch, where you become sleepy, and the body is basically allowing you to sleep at that time. And the other is, of course, during your normal nighttime. But in the evening, we call the evening the forbidden zone for sleep. And the reason for that is the clock is really giving a strong alertness signal, so that even if you're trying to sleep, you can. So understanding in yourself, where are the windows for sleep that you have, and getting that total amount of sleep that you need across the day. Because if you try to sleep at an inappropriate window, what will happen is you may get some sleep, but the sleep is very disturbed and quite shallow. And so-called sleep efficiency, the amount of sleep you get per hour in bed, declines. So understanding your own clock and where are the times that you will sleep well, and trying to get the total amount of sleep across the day, I think is an important strategy. Because what you're doing is you're cheating your biology by what you've been asked to do.
Well, what happens with the parents of a newborn? The baby cries throughout the night. You get up and you try to calm it down. For mothers, often it means breastfeeding as well. They're getting interrupted sleep all the time.
Sure. No, there's a lot of people. I mean,
so are they? Is this causing them a lot of trouble for that, for the period until the child starts sleeping throughout the night?
Well, clearly they're going to be excessively sleepy during the day. They don't get enough sleep, and that's where we talked about earlier, you know, having naps that you can give you some degree of restoration, as long as not too long, because it affects the next night's sleep. So really what you're talking about in these situations are coping mechanisms, essentially. How can I make sure that in a day, despite these interruptions and the other things that I have to do, that I can get the total amount of sleep that I need across the day?
Another listener points out that the French eat quite late, the Spanish eat even later, and wonders if it's a good idea to eat a big meal right before you go to bed. Of course, in Spain, they do have that siesta, which we don't have in this country, unless you live in certain parts of this country, and the boss looks the other way.
Well, in general, I think... I don't have much difficulties with eating time, unless they're going to cause certain gastrointestinal discomfort when there's a temporal association with that. However, we do have to keep in mind that in many countries, you know, ingesting alcohol is routine with meals, and as we noted before, alcohol can certainly disrupt continuity of sleep, and certainly the more alcohol you drink, the more likely that's going to happen. So we have to be keenly aware of that association. Also, insomnia is a very prevalent condition. The overall prevalence of insomnia is reported to be approximately 33%, and if you include daytime symptoms, then it lowers to about 10%, and caffeine is often associated with propagating insomnia. And so when you include, you know, caffeine with meals in one form or another, we have to be very careful of that. So I think meals in general aren't a problem, but you do have to look at what is the content of those meals, and to understand how those might negatively impact sleep.
We have a caller now, Esther from Norwalk, Connecticut. Hi, Esther. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Yes. Hi, Esther.
My question is about dreaming. I have very, very vivid dreams. I feel like I'm all over the place while I'm sleeping. Am I still getting enough rest, even though I'm dreaming and I do remember my dreams when I get up?
Well, I think one of the aspects is that, first of all, it used to be thought that dreams were only isolated to REM state or REM sleep, but that's no longer the case. We can essentially dream in all stages of sleep, including non-REM. However, it seems that the highest dream frequency does appear to be REM, but nonetheless, you can dream in all stages of sleep. What appears to be happening in dreams, in order to recall a dream, there has to be some type of awakening within an hour after the dream. If you have an awakening outside of that hour, there won't be an opportunity to put that dream into longer-term memory. So essentially, we all dream every night. We just may not remember it. So the idea that you're actually dreaming tells us that there's probably some sort of awakening that allows you to remember it.
Now, do we have any idea? I've had so many conflicting reports from guests as to whether dreams have any real significance or not, what they actually do, whether they play a role in memory or other aspects of our waking life. Do we know yet?
Well, we need to separate dreaming from REM sleep. So, you know, there's ongoing research concerning the importance of REM sleep and its involvement with the consolidation of memory. That is separate from the importance of dreaming, which is an altogether different question. And, you know, there are some elements within science that think that dreaming are of importance from mental and emotional health. That tends to come from psychology and psychiatry, and that is an avenue which I do not support. I think current trends and research in cognitive neuroscience reveal that there actually is a basically a neuroscientific explanation for dreams, and that's really based upon modulation of neurotransmitters within the brain. And basically what you're seeing is a modulation of, you know, cholinergic hyperstimulation of certain parts of the brain that are associated with these type of human experience at that certain point in time during sleep, and actually are rarely truly associated with any type of mental health or emotional fallout, and it just happens to be an association, but of really no clinical consequence. That would be arguable, but that's currently what the trend in neuroscience is pointing to.
Now, we have pretty much no time, but Alan, I did want to ask you one more question. What happens on a cellular level when we sleep? Is sleep important for healing and restoring cells?
Yeah, I mean, what we see during sleep is that the genes that turn on during sleep are genes involved in synthesis of new molecules, so in synthesis of new proteins, of synthesis of cholesterol in your brain, and so on. So the notion would be that sleep is a stage of restoration and repair. And when you're awake, you use the energy resources you have, the glucose and all of that, for firing your neurons and keeping yourself alert. When you go to sleep, you switch your energy resources into rebuilding the key molecules so that you're ready for the next day. So it's a stage, I mean, the data at the gene level would suggest it's a stage of restoration and repair.
We couldn't get into a lot of other things I wanted to talk about, like sleepwalking and narcolepsy, but... Mm. Well, we can always return to sleep because it's such a big subject, and I thank the both of you so much for being part of today's Please Explain segment. Dr. Alan Pack, Chief of the Division of Sleep Medicine and Professor of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Michelle Kramer-Borneman, Co-Director of the Minnesota Regional Sleep Disorder Center at Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis.